Hello, this is Eileen, and I will be reading the Decatur Herald and Review for today, Wednesday, January 4th, 2017. Happy New Year! First article, Mentoring Program Forges Link Between Decatur and African Students, by Danette Beckett, in Decatur. James Nathan, a chemist with Archer Daniels Midland Company, introduced himself to a group of Eisenhower High School girls during a lunch meeting with food from his native land of Liberia. The girls are members of the mentoring group 20 Women, learning about different cultures and how to improve their own lives. The group of female mentors and students meet every other Thursday during lunch. They have recently begun communicating with four students from Liberia through Skype and pre-recorded videos. Since he knew the young women were learning about his country, Nathan, 46, thought his meal was an easy way to get their attention. "A lot of the food is similar to America down south," he said. "We make things a little differently. For example, in Liberia, shish kebabs are simply called roasted meat, and kala is what you might call hush puppies with a slight variation," he said. "But they are better than hush puppies." When cooking for a large group, Nathan will keep the flavor mild. "Liberian food is spicy, but because I'm cooking for different backgrounds, I don't add spice," he said. Nathan wanted to speak with the students about Liberia because he knows the two nations are interrelated. Liberia was formed by free slaves in 1822. Many traditions and customs are still common, such as the use of English and clothing trends. He also wants to expose the plight of water conditions in Liberia to the students. Nathan is also an alumni of the same school in Liberia in which the schools have begun to bond. "The goal is to bring them up to speed and explain the chemistry side of water," Nathan said. During the meeting, the students, primarily African American girls, seemed impressed by Liberia's progression for people of color. However, the students are still confused by what they have seen in the media. "Is everyone skinny there like the commercials?" one student asked. Nathan gave a quick no, then moved on to the topic at hand. Consuelo Cruz, founder of the 20 Women group, invited Nathan to speak with the Eisenhower group because they will be working with the students from Cathedral School in Monrovia, Liberia. The two groups are hoping to create a reverse osmosis filtration system for the Liberian school. As a microbiologist for ADM, Cruz understands the importance of clean water. "Water is life," she said. "In Decatur, you are able to just turn on the tap and get clean water. A lot goes into making that clean water. It's not a concern for kids in central Illinois, but globally, it is a huge concern. Wars have started over clean water." Cruz has taught the groups about water chemistry, such as the molecular weight of water, how to use water in daily life, and how water functions in the body. Together with Nathan, Cruz teaches water science and contamination. The Liberian school has to buy its water by the truckload once a week, costing about $500. The school's long-term goal is to obtain a reverse osmosis filtration system so that they can purify their water. Cruz and the students are teaching them about filtration and reverse osmosis. "We would like to help them so they can be water independent," Cruz said. Eisenhower Jr. Nasia Lee has had various experiences during her time in 20 Women. She created a project last year for the school's science fair on schizophrenia, for which she was awarded a $50 gift card from a local department store. "We learn a lot about how our bodies work," she said, "and how the things we learn at school we can apply to everyday life." The group has also learned about their future and the jobs available. They have had various visitors attend their meetings, including librarians and future NBA players, as well as scientists. We talk about issues relevant to improving their lives, Cruz said. During the last meeting, the students and mentors discussed the Iberia culture and how the two countries are related and different. Employees from Crossing Healthcare and Vida Center for Women spent the remainder of the meeting explaining important women's health issues to the group of approximately 15 students. To be a member of 20 Women, the students are recommended by the principal. Maybe they had some conflict of interest with teachers or other issues, Cruz said. We want to provide a safety net for them and give them resources. Unlike the Eisenhower students, the four students from Iberia, Rocky Clark, Benita Panicapala, Lawrence Gibson, and Princess Ola, were chosen because they are at the top of their class academically. Since it was created in 2013, 20 Women has had 6 Eisenhower students attend college, and they are successfully getting through school, Cruz said. That is our objective, to prevent dropouts. During his speech with the students, Nathan gave examples from his homeland of people who have had high achievements. For example, Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was the first democratically elected female president in Africa and is a Harvard-trained economist. In 2011, she won a Nobel Peace Prize. There are a lot of things you can do as females, Nathan said. Don't limit yourself. Nathan went on to explain the creation of Liberia by free slaves from the United States and the Caribbean. Since it was established, Liberia has had 24 presidents, 23 of whom were black. People who work on plantations become presidents and doctors, and now there are chemists and engineers. Nathan said no matter what situation you find yourself in today, you have a lot of potentials. Next article. Using cell phones without fear of death. This is from the Associated Press in Iraq. Iraqis who escaped Islamic State rule during the battle for Mosul are indulging in a newfound freedom, the right to check their phones. When the Iraqi offensive to retake the northern city began in mid-October, its Islamic State rulers warned residents that anyone caught with an active mobile phone would be killed for spying. Many destroyed their SIM cards, and at least one terrified resident flushed his phone down the toilet. Others hid their devices where the militants were unlikely to look, under women's clothing, at the bottom of a wardrobe, or in a bird coop on the roofs of their home. For many, the phones came in handy later, when they were able to phone the military to coordinate their escape. After arriving in camps for the displaced, they were able to reach out to loved ones and return to social media after a virtual 2-year blackout. Sam Yassin, a primary school teacher, was one of those who took the risk and hid his phone. Before he fled Mosul about a week ago, he used it sparingly, walking under cover of darkness to high ground where he could get a signal strong enough to call family in Baghdad. We were so isolated from the outside world, but I still needed to let them know that we, especially my elderly mother, are okay, Yassin said. It's a great feeling. I miss being in touch with everyone, he said after retrieving his phone from one of the camp's power vendors. Those entrepreneurs are displaced Iraqis with small generators who recharge phones for 500 dinars. That's about 45 cents. The camp does not provide electricity. Seize Mosul, the country's second largest city, IS, in the summer of 2014, when the extremists swept across the western and northern Iraq. 10 weeks into the offensive, the militants still hold most of that city. On taking the city, it's implemented a radical interpretation of Islamic teachings, including a ban on smoking. Men were required to grow beards, and women in public had to cover themselves from head to toe. The group initially allowed the use of mobile phones in Mosul under the set of intrusive restrictions. Militants at checkpoints and on foot patrols routinely checked people's phones, looking for suspicious numbers, music, or photos, which were also banned. A few months later, the militants destroyed all the mobile towers, but residents said that on higher ground they could still pick up a weak signal from the nearby Kurdish region. Diamen Ahmed, a Mosul native, who now lives in Sudinan camp for the displaced near Mosul, ran a business providing internet lines to homes and charging customers to log on in the shop. His enforcers made him install a security camera at the shop so they could monitor his clients. They would come every week and demand to see the video recordings and the names of those who came to the shop, he said. Ahmed eventually decided it was too much trouble, closed the shop last February, and started selling food instead. They still taxed me, but there were no questions and no visits, he said, as he carried two shopping bags filled with tomatoes and onions back to his tent. Phone cards were available in Mosul for a short time after IS took the city. Later, users relied on relatives and friends for phone-to-phone credit transfers. One major Iraqi provider built new signal towers south of the city last fall, while another ran TV and radio advertisements showing toll-free numbers residents could call to report emergencies or provide information about the militants. IS grew increasingly paranoid after the U.S.-backed Iraqi offensive to retake the city began in October, residents said. Anyone found with an active phone was presumed to be a spy and shot dead on the spot. But those who held on to their devices were able to call the military on hotline numbers broadcast by local media in order to help their escape. The military would advise them of the best route out and deploy drones or helicopter gunships to protect them. Mahdi Saleh, 19, used phone credit sent to him by an uncle in the city of Kirkuk to ensure that he and dozens of families from Mosul's Somar neighborhood could escape. The uncle, after consulting with the military and other residents who had fled, provided directions, and they were safe out a week ago. In the refugee camp, Salem is enjoying the freedom he has not had in a very long time. I can now speak on the phone as often as I want to and in front of everyone, he said, after chatting with his aunt in Kirkuk. I can smoke too, he said. Next article, Trump crime aid offer for Chicago may be difficult. From the Associated Press by Michael Tarm in Chicago. President-elect Donald Trump says Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel should ask for federal help if he isn't able to bring down a homicide count that soared last year to 762. Chicago saw the most killings in nearly two decades and more than New York and Los Angeles combined. Trump pointed to the spike in shooting deaths earlier this week in the posting on Twitter, writing, "If Mayor can't do it, he must ask for federal help." Despite Trump's tweet, the federal government has already been involved, albeit with mixed results, via the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and other agencies. Trump isn't the first to broach the idea that the U.S. government could do more to help stem deadly violence in Chicago. But now, as on earlier occasions, what more the federal government can do isn't at all clear. Here is a look at the issues and some of the options that might be available. First, the numbers. In addition to the 762 homicides, Chicago saw a jump in shooting incidents overall from 2,426 in 2015 to 3,550 in 2016. The bulk of deaths and shooting incidences occurred in only 5 of the city's 22 police districts on the city's south and west sides, all poor and predominantly black areas where gangs are most active. Police said the shootings in those areas generally weren't random, with more than 80% of the victims having previously been identified by police as more vulnerable because of their gang ties or past arrests. The National Guard. The most direct and most extreme intervention would be sending National Guard troops into Chicago to try and tap the violence. Both the president and the Illinois governor have the authority to mobilize the Illinois National Guard, but federal statute known as the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 prohibits federal troops from being deployed in civil law enforcement. While a president could try to find legal loopholes to get around that prohibition, the legalities of such deployment would pose major obstacles. A heavy-handed intervention could upset many conservatives who advocate for state rights. Trump has not broached the possibility of using troops, although the idea comes up from time to time in Illinois. When someone asked Governor Bruce Rauner about the possibility in August, he ruled it out. He said he had discussed the idea with police, community leaders, and the National Guard, and that no thoughtful leader thinks that's a good idea would really provide a solution. The U.S. Attorney. Current U.S. Attorney Zachary Farden came under pressure to put violent crime at the top of the city's agenda when elected to be the top federal law enforcement official in Chicago 3 years ago. But from the start of his tenure, he tempered expectations about what a U.S. Attorney's office could do. He had said repeatedly that communities couldn't arrest their way out of a problem of violence, and that a more holistic approach, one that also addresses socioeconomic problems, is required. As the homicide count in Chicago rose to an alarming level, Farden said in September's speech that his office and federal agencies, including the FBI, DEA, and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, have ramped up their resources to help tamp down the spike in violence. He also said federal agencies had launched new crime-fighting programs with the city and state officials, though he didn't provide details. He added about the bid to bring violence down, suffice it to say, all oars from those agencies, including the FBI, are in the water right now. Gangs. Going decades back, a cornerstone of anti-violence measures by U.S. attorneys in Chicago has been to convict and imprison gang members. Federal prosecutors in Chicago have used racketeering and gun laws to go after gangs, who police blame for much of the deadly violence. One of the largest street gangs cases in recent Chicago history is wrapping up this month in U.S. District Court, with 6 reputed leaders of Notorious Hobos street gang on trial for an alleged racketeering conspiracy that prosecutors say included at least 9 killings. But many gang experts point to an unintended consequence of prosecuting gang leaders. Breaking up a gang's command structure can often lead to more inter-gang rivalry and therefore lead to more violence. And the last headline article from the front page, Trump Ethics Shift Ill Time by Erica Warner. Washington. The new GOP era in Washington got off to a messy start Tuesday as House Republicans under pressure from President-elect Donald Trump, abruptly dropped plans to gut an independent congressional ethics board. The dizzying about-face came as lawmakers convened for the first day of the 115th Congress, an occasion normally reserved for pomp and ceremony under the Capitol dome. Instead, House Republicans found themselves under attack not only from Democrats, but from their new president, over their secretive move Monday to neuter the independent Office of Congressional Ethics and place it under lawmakers' control. GOP leaders scrambled to contain the damage, and within hours of Trump registering his criticism on Twitter, they called an emergency meeting where House Republicans voted without opposition to undo the change. The episode, coming even before the new Congress was convened and lawmakers were sworn in, was a powerful illustration of the sway Trump may hold over his party in Washington that will be fully under Republican control for the first time in a decade. GOP lawmakers, who felt unfairly targeted by the ethics office, had defied their own leaders with their initial vote to straitjacket the body. But once Trump weighed in, they backpedaled immediately. With all the Congress has to work on, do they really have to make the weakening of the independent ethics watchdog, as unfair as it may be, their number one act and priority? Trump had asked over Twitter on Tuesday morning. The objection appeared focused more on the timing than on substance. Trump, who will take office in a little more than 2 weeks, said the focus should be on tax reform and health care, and he included the hashtag DTS for Drain the Swamp, his oft-repeated campaign promise to bring change to Washington. Democrats and even many Republicans were quick to point out that the lawmakers' plan for their ethics watchdog flew in the face of that notion. The measure was part of the GOP written rules package that faced a vote in the full House late Tuesday and looked like it could fail after Trump registered his objections amid a public outcry for good government activists. "We were elected on a promise to drain the swamp, and starting the session by relaxing ethics rules is a very bad start," said GOP Representative Tom McClintock of California. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy mentioned Trump's opposition in the emergency meeting, and some lawmakers said it had a powerful effect. "I do believe when President-elect Trump tweeted out, members got calls," said Representative Lou Barletta, Republican from Pennsylvania. Trump spoke by phone with House Speaker Paul Ryan on Tuesday after the ethics change was dropped. The House of Congressional Ethics was created in 2008 after several bribery and corruption cases in the House, but lawmakers of both parties have groused about the way it operates. Lawmakers were especially incensed by an investigation of members of Congress from both parties who went on a 2013 trip and to Azerbaijan, paid for by that country's government. Lawmakers said after the investigation was made public in 2015 that they had no idea the trip was paid for by the government, and the House Ethics Committee ultimately cleared them. Once the ethics controversy was dispersed with, Congress returned to the ceremonial business. As set out in the Constitution, both chambers gaveled in at noon, and the halls of the Capitol filled with lawmakers' children, families, and spouses to witness the procedures. The day had a festive feel of the first day back to school, as new arrivals roamed the halls with old hands. In the Senate, seven new members joined those who won re-election, taking the oath of office administered by Vice President Joe Biden. The Senate will be controlled 52-48 by the GOP and includes two new Republicans and five new Democrats. They include Illinois' Tammy Duckworth, a double amputee Iraqi war Iraq war vet who walked to the dais and stood for the oath. Biden remains president of the Senate until Trump becomes president on January 20th. Then Vice President-elect Mike Pence will take over. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York set battle lines, saying Democrats will hold Trump to his promise to create jobs, raise incomes, and protect Americans, but will fight him tooth and nail when he appeals to the baser instincts that diminish America and its greatness. Issues confronting America are complex, he said, and we cannot tweet them away. In the House, lawmakers easily reelected Ryan of Wisconsin as the Speaker. The House will number 241 Republicans and 194 Democrats. Among the members are 52 freshmen. Behind the ceremony was a sense of anticipation as Republicans prepare an ambitious agenda, beginning with dismantling President Barack Obama's health care law. That will start with the procedural vote later this week in the Senate. But there was certainly, too, as Republicans confront an untested new president who has opposed fundamental elements of GOP orthodoxy and may exercise his influence in unpredictable ways, as illustrated with the ethics kerfuffle. The people have given us unified government, and it wasn't because they were feeling generous. It's because they want results, Ryan said. How could we live with ourselves if we let them down? And here are some briefs for Wednesday. Indicator, there was a house fire. Firefighters spent 3 hours Tuesday at the scene of a residential blaze that caused significant damage to the home. The department was dispatched to a one-story house at 603 South Jackson Street at 8:13 a.m. Tuesday, according to fire officials. Crews found heavy smoke pouring out from all openings in the house and fire in the rear bedroom. An injured person was found next door and taken to HSHS St. Mary's Hospital. Battalion Chief Dan Klein said Tuesday afternoon that the person's injuries were not life-threatening and not caused by the fire itself. No one was located in the house. The blaze was under control by 8:45 a.m., but firefighters spent 3 hours on the scene because of what Klein described as a lot of content in several rooms. One firefighter was also treated at St. Mary's Hospital for a medical issue, Klein said. The cause remains under investigation by the Decatur Fire Department and Decatur Police Department. And also there were drug charges. A man allegedly driving around with a vehicle license sticker he had pried off of his daughter's car was charged with drug offenses after police searched his vehicle. Sworn statements say that 34-year-old Decatur suspect's van was pulled over in Forsyth at 11:35 p.m. Friday by a Macon County Sheriff deputy who says its registration was expired. The suspect allegedly told police his license was suspended and he had helped himself to the sticker on his daughter's car. The officer said he searched the van and found a syringe, two glass smoking devices, and four clear bags containing a white powdery residue, a razor blade, and two plastic snorting devices with white powdery residue. A later field test showed the residue in the bags positive for ecstasy methamphetamine, according to the police. The suspect said the drug paraphernalia belonged to his ex-girlfriend who uses meth and heroin. However, he was jailed on possession of a controlled substance and possession of drug paraphernalia. Okay, I'm going to take a brief break and I will be right back. This has been Eileen with the Decatur Herald and Review. I will return shortly.